was a Gail Lederman from Adult Protection Service lady. She came over and was introduced by Officer Devereaux to my boss and says, Dorothy Shuri, can I help you with anything? My boss is very clear. I don't see how you can help me. And she asked again, and my boss says the same story. It says, well, I don't see how can you help me. I'm fine. And my boss asked them to leave and then didn't want to do that.
So you never said to her that you wanted him to stop talking to her?
No, I never even talked to him. I was about 10 feet away from him when he get up and started punching me in the face.
Okay. In answer to my questions, Mr. Shuri told me she had gone to an attorney yesterday to stop Nancy from getting to her money. She explained she signed a power of attorney for Honor and Fernandez so they could keep Nancy from her money. Mrs. Shuri did not know who the attorney was. She explained that a friend gave her an attorney's name, but that attorney was unavailable. She was not certain how she came to select the attorney she went to, other than to say he was in the phone book. Is this true?
Yes.
I asked Mrs. Shuri if she understood that the power of attorney gave Anna and Fernando access to all of her money. Mrs. Shuri stated she did not know that. As I spoke with Mrs. Shuri about the power of attorney, Fernando again attempted to prompt Mrs. Shuri and keep her from answering my questions.
No, this is false. This is not true because he never said that to her. All he did is he got up and started punching me in the face. And then we walked out of the bedroom, and that was it.
Okay. Did he ever have a conversation with her in which he mentioned these things?
No. He never had time to do that.
Now, were you with her pretty much at all times, or could he have done this before or after you were there?
No. He pushed me out of the house, and my boss was only with the lady from Adult Protection Services alone in the room. As far as the transcription says in the audio tape that I posted in the bedroom, the transcription says very clearly that my boss tried to call 911 and the lady from Adult Protection Services lady pulled the phone away from her.
And this is a transcription of a tape that Devereaux had, or that you were had?
Yes, I was recording the audio tape only to prove that I'm innocent into this. And Officer Devereaux saves the tape and is telling everybody that the tape is only questioning my boss about checking accounts.
Do you have a copy of the tape?
I do have a copy of the tape. Perfect. Anybody is welcome to listen to these audio tapes.
We can play that on free radio.
Yes. We can listen these audio tapes. I have copies. I know he came over to my sister's house and did the illegal search and saved these audio tapes, but I have copies of it. He knows that I have the copies.
Okay. Continuing. I asked Mrs. Shuri, this is again Sergeant Devereaux's report, of an incident that happened a year and a half ago. I asked Mrs. Shuri if she understood that the power of attorney gave Anna and Fernando, that's you and your sister, access to all of her money. Mrs. Shuri said she did not know that. I think I'm reading what I read before. Oh, no. As I spoke to Mrs. Shuri about the power of attorney, Fernando again attempted, here we are, to prompt Mrs. Shuri and keep her from answering my questions. I advised Fernando to sit down or I would remove him from the room. Did he do that?
Yes, he removed me from...
No, but did he tell you, sit down or I will remove you from the room?
No, he never told me that.
Okay.
We didn't have time to do that. The only thing you can see this report, if you read it, you're going to see how he fabricates the reports and lies to the court. Because he's used to do that. We have more cases. Anybody of you want to know about these cases, we got the people that you can talk about it, how he's been fabricating these illegal lies and bringing charges to anybody. Yes, to access the money. That's what I have to find out.
Okay, then we can get you and some of these other people concerned about Sergeant Devereaux, and we'll invite him to come on the air too, of course, to speak on free radio.
Yes.
Continuing with this, I advised Fernando to sit down or I would remove him from the room. In answering further questions, Mrs. Shuri stated it was never her intention to give Anna or Fernando access to her money. True or false?
False.
She understood from Fernando that they needed the power of attorney to stop Nancy from stealing from her. True or false?
False.
Okay, what is false about it?
Just one, I want to make a statement. See, if she's giving us the power of attorney, why all the rest of the questions? They will tell you that she was aware in the lawyers who make the power of attorney. She signed this power of attorney knowing that she wanted to do that. Besides, she won the...
She has the right to remain silent as well, even if she's in a criminal investigation, and she's not the suspect, she's the complainant, so she doesn't want to talk to Sergeant Devereaux. She doesn't have to. Did she ever tell him, I don't want to talk to you?
Well, one of the questions, she didn't want Officer Devereaux to know about their chain accounts. That's private. That's what she told me, and that's what she told him, that was a privacy from her checking accounts. She didn't want to give her the power because Officer Devereaux asked her to sign the power of attorney to him.
Officer Devereaux asked her to?
Asked my boss to sign a power of attorney to go and check the checking accounts.
To give him the power of attorney?
Yes.
Did she ever say to him, I don't want to talk to you?
No.
Okay. So she was talking to him voluntarily. I then asked Mrs. Schutte if she was aware of Fernando's arrest record or the shooting in Monterey. Can you hold this for me?
Yes.
Thanks. Mrs. Schutte said she knew about these things, but was clearly confused and becoming upset. And, of course, what you're saying is that she said that it didn't bother her, right?
No. Yes.
Did they have that conversation at all or not?
Yes, they had a conversation, but she said that she was aware of this situation. But Officer Devereaux is writing this against me because he wanted to fabricate lies into all this.
So he was having a conversation with her, and again, this is prior to his hitting you?
Can you repeat that again?
Before he hit you and pushed you out of the house, was he having a conversation with her?
Yes, he was having a conversation with her, and then he got up and started punching him in the face. But according to the report, you know, we can check that Officer Devereaux wrote in the reports that I wanted to access the money, that I went to the Bank of America to put on my boss accounts, which is a lie. The people and the manager from Bank of America came over to the court and testified that I never asked her to do that. All I asked is only to stop Nancy Waxman from stealing the money.
Was it in a preliminary hearing or before a judge and in camera? Or?
Yeah, it was in the preliminary hearing.
Which judge?
Judge Catalina Cao.
Gag me. Fernando again interrupted my questioning of Mrs. Schutte. I advised Fernando he was to leave the room. True or false?
That is true. He told me that he wanted me to shut up, but I wasn't even talking when he told me that.
Now, had you said something before?
No, I never said anything. I let me tell you the story. Around 2:15, he came over, knocked at the door. I let him go into the living room. I present the power attorney, and since that, he started punching me all over from the hall to the, my boss' bedroom. And then I kept quiet. He started talking to my boss and asking her questions and saying that Fernando and Anna wanted to access her money and had a power attorney. My boss says that she was aware of all of this. That's when he got mad, he was turning red, and he got up and started punching him in the face.
Did he punch you before this or after?
That was after this.
So you said, you just said a moment ago that he came in and started punching you, and then he talked to her. So he talked to her before he began to punch you?
No, we got into this confusion on the talking right now. I said he was talking to Dorothy Schutte, and then when I was talking to the lady from the Doctor's Protection Services lady, then he left talking from Dorothy Schutte, came up to us, and started punching him in the face.
So the chronology was he comes into the house, he doesn't start punching you yet. He starts, he talks to her, or he talks to the Adult Protective Services woman, and then before or after he talks to her, he begins punching you in the face?
That was at the time that I was talking to the lady from Adult Protection Services.
Had he been talking to her, Mrs. Schutte?
At that time, he was talking to Mrs. Schutte.
So after he began talking to her, he began to punch her in the face?
Yes.
So he says here that Fernando again interrupted my questioning of Mrs. Schutte. I advised Fernando he was to leave the room. True or false?
That's false.
And what is false about it?
It's false because he never told me that because I wasn't even talking to him. I was talking to the lady from Adult Protection Services. And before that, I was quiet, and I was standing by the room, but I wasn't talking to anybody.
Did he tell you to leave the room, though, for whatever reason?
Oh, no. He's talking about this, leaving the room. It was the prior day that he came over on October the 2nd.
Oh, but he didn't tell you on this particular day?
Not on on October the 4th.
Okay. So I again advise, Fernando started to pick up the phone stating he was calling the police. True or false?
False.
Did you ever pick up a phone and say you were calling the police?
No, I wasn't. At that time, I wasn't picking up the phone. I tried to pick up the phone when I was in the kitchen. That's when he pulled the phone away from me.
And did that happen before or after he assaulted you?
That was after.
Okay. As we got to the living room, Fernando started screaming, "Why are you killing me?"
It's because he was punching me on the face and twisting my arm.
But you did say that?
Yes.
Which is one of the things quite appropriate to say. I had not touched Fernando at this point.
It's false.
I advised Fernando to put down the phone and leave the house. He began to punch you. Then you went into the kitchen, and then you picked up the phone, and then he told you?
No, he pushed me all over to the kitchen.
And then you tried to phone the police?
Yes. When I was walking by the kitchen, I tried to grab the cordless phone and call the police.
And what did he do?
He took the phone away from me.
Okay. I then grabbed his left arm and moved him toward the front door. Fernando flailed his arm, swung it towards me, yelling, "Why are you hitting me?"
It's false.
What is false about it?
It's false because the only thing I was saying that he was hurting me.
Okay. Was he hitting you?
Yes, he was punching me. Even you can tell my shirt is a rip-off. This is the same shirt that I was wearing on October the 4th.
Again, other than grabbing Fernando's arm, I never struck him or used any other force against him.
Well, this is a lie, because we have the proofs here on the report that he's been lying and making false reports to the court.
Fernando then pushed me backward, and I was able to pin him against the front door. Fernando was able to open the door and ran down the driveway toward Orchard Heights.
Some part is true. I ran over to Orchard Heights, to the neighbor, to ask for help.
I contacted NETCOM and requested the assistance of a uniformed officer. I provided a description of Fernando to the responding units. Deputy Murphy arrived a short while later. Deputy Murphy, what? you got all the worst, man,
yes.
With Fernando in his car. He explained that Fernando flagged him down, saying, "I beat him up." Fernando stepped out of the car, and I placed him under arrest for 148 PC. As Deputy Murphy searched Fernando for weapons, I noticed a Bank of America business card in his pocket. In fact, there were two, and I retrieved both. How did Deputy Murphy treat you?
Well, he was treating me right, but the only thing, when I told him that Officer Deverell was punching me in the face, he didn't want to believe me, and he told me that he was his supervisor. There's nothing I can do. That's what he told me. He's my supervisor.
I see. Who was the witness, the next-door neighbor that you went to?
I don't have the name on hand, but there was a lady and a man who saw me with my shirt ripped. And besides that, you know, Officer Deverell told Officer Murphy that I shot a man on the head 4 or 5 times, which is a lie.
Wow. And when did he tell him this?
When the day he was bringing me back to 15-year Orchard Heights.
The day of this incident? Or?
Yes, the day of the incident.
And did he say this in front of anybody else?
No, there were only Officer Deverell and Officer Murphy and myself.
Okay. Let's take a look at your arm. Maybe I can get a picture of it. Camera here, so I can't take a picture, but you said you went to doctors on duty.
Yes, I went on doctors on duty after I was released from jail. That was Saturday, October the 6th.
5 days later?
Yes, and they took
medical treatment at the jail?
No, they didn't give me anything. Besides, they never recorded that I was assaulted by this officer. I told them, but they didn't want to listen to me. Second, when I was in doctors on duty, they took pictures of my arm and my face on my body. They are aware of this, and I have the report from doctors on duty.
The name of the doctor is?
I don't have on hand the name of the doctor, but I have the record.
Okay, now, what kind of injuries did you suffer?
My arm and my eyeball, they were hurt in my back. I have a hernia, and he punched me several times in the hernia, and I'm suffering pain on that. This is coming out again, because I had a surgery. And
have they been delaying? I'm sorry, you have surgery?
I had the surgery in like 7 months before this incident, and he started punching me on the stomach.
Now, is the reason for the delay in your trial because the prosecution has been asking for more time, or because the defense has been asking for more time?
It's because we don't have a lawyer.
You've been asking for more time?
Yes, I've been asking for more time.
Have you filed a claim against the county for this action?
Yes, I did.
Good. So you got the claim in. Well, we're talking with
Fernando Espino.
And Fernando, you spoke before the Board of Supervisors. Unfortunately, in a speech I was not able to record, happened right after mine here today. And you're invited to come and speak on free radio, and I'll give you the times and places and bring your information. And hopefully we can get the word out on what's going on. Let's get a copy of the police report at some point if you're able to give me one. I'm just one individual. I do a show about civil rights for poor people and people who are victims of police misconduct. So here's your durable power of attorney.
Here is a copy of the power. Here is a copy of the power of attorney that
Dorothy Schutte gave you.
Mm-hmm. That Dorothy Schutte gave me to my sister and I.
Right.
And it's notarized, as you can see here.
And it's notarized, yeah, by Barbara Carson.
It's legal. Mm-hmm. And then we have a letter from the people from the bank, which is Cynthia Raymond, and right here says, "I asked Cynthia if Fernando has asked to withdraw money from any of Dorothy's bank accounts." She says no. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If we look into another lady from the bank, and we read the same, it will tell you the same story, that I never tried to access the money.
So I mean, I don't think you need to, you know, reassure me about this, although I certainly would, you know, I'm happy to hear the other side from Sergeant Deverell or whoever else would be involved.
We have here Terry Rapos from Washington Mutual. Says, Terry said that he was talking to me.
Terry is who?
Terry Rapos.
The bank manager?
Yes, he's the manager from Washington Mutual Bank.
I mean, my impression is that, and you have a lot of documentation here that shows.
See right here, it says.
I asked Terry if Fernando presented Terry with the power of attorney, and he said no. She answered. Terry said she and Fernando just talked. Whether you tried to withdraw money from the account, no, he never tried to withdraw money. So you are still on trial for what? Trying to steal money for these
yes.
accounts?
Yes.
And the attorney, the district attorney who's in charge of this case, his name is?
David Finocchio.
And your own attorney has been postponing this because you're looking for another attorney.
Yes, we are looking for another attorney because the attorney that I had, the public defender, he told me that I need to turn guilty in order that they remove the charges from my sister.
What are the charges from your sister?
The charges from my sister, there are the same charges on me, elderly abuse, chicken torture, possessing illegal cockfighting, which is a lie.
Illegal what?
Cockfighting.
Cockfighting?
Yes. Which is a lie. She works as a...
Was she jailed as well, or no?
Yes. They end up arresting my sister illegally, and she had to bail out, too.
I see. How long was she in jail?
She spent a couple of hours because I tried to bail out right away.
So have you been harassed since this by the deputy's department last year?
Yes. Every time that she's trying to look for a job, Officer Deborah, I'll call these people and find out the reason how he find out is because he has a line into our telephone, so he's getting all this information.
So you know this because you had somebody independently check your phones, or you just think that's likely to be the case?
Well, as soon as we get a job, he find us very easy. And that will tell us that as soon as we call somebody or getting calls from people, he find out. How does he find out? Can you tell me? He's following us or he's getting the conversations out of our phones?
I hear you.
You can tell when somebody is recording on your cell phone or your home phone because there's a second static voice and that is telling you that there's a recorder attached to this phone.
Are you most of your phone calls on cell or on land phone?
He has the access for home and cell phones too.
Because you need wiretapping locally would require a judicial order unless you're regarded as some kind of a terrorist, in which case I guess they could do it through a federal deal.
I'm not surprised with Officer Deverell that he has the power. Even he's been covered by Mark Tracy, which is his boss.
Just walked that away,
I know. I saw him and I've been asking him to have a day with him because here are the proofs that I'm innocent.
Can I get a copy of that report?
Yes.
We're talking with
Ana Rosa Espino. I'm a sister of Fernando, and I really need your support because I don't want his children lose his father just because this officer decide to cover a crook like Nancy Watson and blame my brother and me for something that we haven't done.
Go ahead, Ana. You were saying that you're concerned about this, and here's Sheriff Mark Tracy. Maybe he has a statement on the subject. Apparently not.
No, he's too busy. He don't care what his officers do. They can portray people, kill people, and he don't care. He just ignore or hide because I don't know what's going on with him. Maybe he's ready to retire and let somebody else do the job. But I know a lot of people in Watsonville are tired of being abused from these deputies. And as a taxpayers, I guess you are concerned because your money is wasting in something that could be safe and spending some programs that people really need, like Social Security, people who's really sick and need medicine, and they can't afford because Social Security pays maybe $300-$400 a month. And I'm able to support somebody that needs my help, and I ask for your support. Thank you.
Well, Ana, how can people support you? Should they give you a phone call? Should they write you? What should they do?
Well, they can support me like writing letters to Mark Tracy, to Mrs. Perry, to Josh Akau, to Josh Burton, because they need to know that the people are supporting each other. I know they have more Latinos in jail. I don't know if this is people racist, but think about these Latinos are the ones who are working in the fields to get your food, my food, food for them. Why they keep all these young children in jail just because they commit one felony?
So, Ana, how long have you been in the Santa Cruz area?
I've been in the Santa Cruz area for 32 years, working in two or three jobs at the same time. My brother and I always been working, and we don't create problems for people. We just want to live in peace and respect people's properties and respect people's rights, but we are the same.
Since you were charged, and I guess jailed for several hours on these charges of What, they're accusing you of stealing money? Or?
Yes, I've been losing a lot of jobs because people don't have the confidence to hire me anymore because Officer DeBarro are calling my clients saying that I'm a thief and calling people for my brother also. That
he's How many clients has he called?
That I know three people. But I'm sure more people, but they don't want to tell me.
How do you know this? How do you know he's called those three?
Because I know, like, for example, my husband now, they came to his attorneys, they came to him and say that he should let me go because I was stealing money from Mrs. Dorothy Schutte. Another lady, she says, I'm sorry, you have a bad record. I cannot give you a job because you've been stealing money from this lady.
She said that Sergeant Devereaux called her, or she just told you that she'd heard you had a record?
An officer called her, and...
You think it was Sergeant Devereaux?
Yeah, he's the one that's been... tape recording my conversation. He's the one that's been putting all these lies in the report, so that's what I'm blaming him.
Have you taken this issue to the newspapers or the media?
Seems like they don't want to do anything because... Officer DeVero had enough power to control everything.
So, for example, the Pajaronian wasn't interested?
No, they're not interested. They never mentioned what happened with Mrs. Schutte. They never been in the paper. They never been in no place.
Have you spoken to a reporter about it?
Yes, we tried to spoke to them, and they don't want to put it in the paper.
Which reporter did you talk to?
Pajaronian, also the Sentinel.
You know the name of the person you talked to?
No, I'm sorry, I can't recall the name right now.
No, okay.
But I know they're afraid of these people because sometimes I feel afraid they're criminals.
Well, you know, as I said, I've extended an invitation to you and your brother to come on Free Radio. I do a show on Sundays. So please, feel free to do that. And anything else you want to say? Is there a phone number people can reach you at? Do you want to give out a number?
247-6021 or 625-2026. And I'm really interested.
Was a tape from March 18th at the Board of Supervisors, right outside the Board of Supervisors meeting, talking to Fernando and then Ana Espino, who are charged with animal cruelty, although they were originally charged with, elder abuse, and they claim that Sergeant Devereaux, in what looks to be a possible DA judicial cover-up, have been targeting them, because they've exposed false police reports and other improper behavior by the sheriff's office, including assault by Sergeant Devereaux, if Fernando Espino's story is correct. However, in a complete shift, we have contacted an old, I'm not sure how old he is, but homeless activist Doug McGrath, who is in Dominican Hospital. I guess he's been transferred to another unit, but he's still... in the hospital, and he's going to give us an on-the-scene report from a man who has again circled the drain and survived. Hey there, Doug.
Hey, how you doing? I just, wanted to. Marilyn talks to a lot of people, and I don't get to talk to them. They've been telling me, you know, that they've been saying prayers and everything, and it must have worked. I went around the drain for a couple of months. I had pneumonia, and then you get high. Temperatures and you go into like hallucinations and stuff. So for the past 5 weeks I've been in here, I haven't known much about what's been going on. Just about the last week I've been waking up, and they've got me over at this special place on Frederick Street right now to get me some little bit of more strength back in my legs so I can walk. And so I'll be here a couple of three more days, and I'll be out, be able to say hi. But tell everybody to be careful about any kind of pneumonia out there, and if you get it, get to the doctor, and get to the doctor fast, because it could be real bad.
Well, don't get any smallpox vaccinations. That's my advice.
Yeah, I don't even know if that was in there either, I tell you.
You've been in there for 5 weeks, so you said three of them you were kind of unconscious and delirious and high fever?
Yeah, for about 2 weeks they had me in this little plastic bag where they had water running below you and above you to keep your temperature down, you know, like that song, you know, the water holds me down, water holds me down, the same as it ever was song, and I don't remember any of that. In fact, I don't remember most of anything. I had to tell you the truth. Marilyn saved my life again. So she did her angel deal again, and looks like I'm gonna be back out on the street again.
Hey, talking to Doug McGrath at Dominican, you're referring to Marilyn Weaver, who is on the Homeless Issues Task Force. And
it's actually Marilyn McGrath. We're married.
Oh, no. You got married?
Yeah, we got married about four. Remember we got married at Paradise Valley?
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Well, you know, I try to ignore these things.
Before it all went bad.
Wow. And I guess you're going to be there for three or four more days? You want people to visit you, or how do
you? Sure, if you want, you can. My number is 457-7160.
457?
Room number 146A.
7160, room 146A. And if
I'm in a double room now. I was in a single room before, so it's all kind of loud in here all of a sudden now.
We can still hear you. Okay, if you want to reach Doug McGrath, you can reach him at 457-7160, room 146A, or come on out to Dominican. Do you know what the visiting hours are?
All day up till like 7:30, I think.
Okay.
And anyone that said hi to Marilyn wanted me to say hi and said their prayers and all of whatever, you know, thank you and hello now, and say I'll be back out, and it looks like I've made the corner, headed on home.
Mm-hmm. Well, good to hear you, Doug, and get well and come back.
And thanks for calling too, Mark. I mean, Robert. See, God dang, I had to learn my first thing, the guitar. There's a lot of few things. Lost a little bit of my brain cells on.
Well, you're just gonna have to use some more, I guess.
I guess so.
Talk to you again.
But y'all take it easy. Yeah, I woke up to the war. The war wasn't going on when I got in here, and I woke up and there was going on.
I wish the American people would wake up.
That was part of my damn weird dream, too. I don't know.
From a dream
I can tell you some
happen.
Of the hallucinations I had about that. That was weird.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you, Doug, and what we should try to do is get you a radio, I guess.
I've got one. I'm just sitting in some little hole over here where you can't receive anything.
Well, Doug, okay, if anybody wants to reach you, it's 457-7160, room 146A.
That's it.
And if you forget that number, call 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I'll give it to you again.
And tell everybody thanks, said hi, and y'all take it easy, and take care of yourself, man. You can just all of a sudden, you don't have to do nothing to get this. It's all of a sudden you just got it.
Yep. And if you're homeless, it's easier to die of it. That's
you can be a good boy, you know. You don't have to walk out here going, wow, I'm not like going to jail or nothing. I'm just like sick. I wasn't a bad boy.
You take care, Doug.
You too. Bye-bye.
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And we don't care if you're in a hospital. We hope you're not in a morgue. If you've just gotten beaten up by a sheriff, we don't care. Give us a call. Let's talk. 427-3772. I know Sergeant Deverell has gotten a kind of a reputation from other folks, which hasn't been the best. And in fact, I'm going to try to reach Attorney Kate Wells and see what's cooking with that. We have see if we can get her on the line here. I'm not sure if we got through on that. Let's try again. Let's see what we can do here. It's the old equipment story. I think that we can still do it. Again, we'll be able to, as soon as I get off the line, call in. We're ringing now. Kate.
Hello.
Hey, Kate Wells.
Yeah.
You're on the air with Free Radio.
Okay.
Wasn't that a surprise?
Yes, that's nice of you to let me know ahead of time.
Well, actually, you know, we like to catch you sort of en flagrante delicto, so to speak.
I see. Okay.
Well, I know that we're going to talk to you a bit about the war, but I you may have heard, perhaps you haven't, this lengthy interview with Fernando Espino about.
No, I didn't hear it.
Ah, you didn't hear it.
No.
Okay. But I know that you've had your dealings with Sergeant Deverell yourself. Mr. Espino accuses Deverell of false police report activity.
Yeah. Well, we actually have a tape. I'm sure you've told your listeners that about the tape we have of Sergeant Deverell with Jerry Henry. In fact, you probably played it.
Remind us.
Oh, well, this was when the controversy was going on down at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center, and Jerry evidently had provoked Sergeant Deverell in some manner, and Sergeant Deverell, with the tape recorder running, said, you just push my buttons, Jerry, and I'll show you what I can do, both legal and illegal, too, okay?
And what did Sergeant Deverell do after he, quote, got his buttons pushed?
Well, we think, and we haven't, you know, are you talking about Laurie?
I'm talking about whatever you know about.
Oh, okay. Well, he then, let's see, what was the next thing? I think he then accused Laurie of, I'm trying to think. He took revenge on Quigley by...
Quigley is a friend of Jerry Henry's and a local activist, right?
Right, right. And Quigley stood up to Deverell several times. So he took revenge on him by filing a false police report saying that he had seen Quigley and his then-girlfriend, Laurie Soderman, trading guns back and forth and license plates back and forth between the trunks of their car, which was, you know, absolutely insane.
That sounds pretty sinister, man.
Yeah.
I've heard of, you know, guns for cocaine and guns for the Contras, but guns for license plates?
Yeah, no, it was a you know, totally bizarre thing because, you know, never happened. But he alleged that this had happened in a police report. But they were never told that this police report existed, and we found out about it later when they tried to justify beating Laurie up in a traffic stop. Later on, let's see, Sergeant, I always get the names mixed up, Hartzner, yeah, Joe Hartzner, and another one of my favorites, and William McAuliffe, who is a defendant in another civil rights lawsuit, stopped Laurie in Aptos Village.
Mm-hmm.
Only they didn't actually stop her in the village. They followed her until she was down Trout Gulch Road in a very dark and remote place.
Mm-hmm.
And then put on their lights and pulled her over. Actually, it was just Hartzner to start, I believe.
Mm-hmm. All these guys are still working in the sheriff's office?
Yeah, he's the one who had the party and got reinstated.
Well, remember? Probably had a second party after that.
Had the 4th of July thing where he stole fireworks. And.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, he. At any rate... She happened to have a tape recorder going because she was still doing work as she went home that evening. What she does entails saying things into a tape recorder,
mm-hmm.
And so the tape recorder's running the entire time. They pull her over. She asks what they stopped her for, and they refuse to answer. And then she asks if she's under arrest, and they refuse to answer that. And at some point, the tape is just spine-chilling because they end up opening the car and yanking her into the road where she is just missed by a van that went by. And, you know, beat her up pretty good and then charge her with resisting arrest and having being an ex-felon with a pepper spray. In possession of pepper spray.
Well, you got to find something to charge her with.
Yeah, well, it was a jar in a can of stuff that had been in this glove compartment for years, evidently, and
mm-hmm.
didn't even know it was in there. But
mm-hmm.
So we went to trial on this, and Sergeant Deverell came to testify at some point, and I'm mixing that up with another trial, but I do know this, and that Richard Quigley testified. This was another case
mm-hmm.
that Deverell was a liar, and Deverell made some noises about suing him, and he says, "Oh well, I'd love for you to. In fact, I'll make out a statement here that says that you're a liar, and have it notarized and and hand it to you, and so that you can then sue me for slander if that's a if that's a lie." And of course, nothing ever happened.
What about the charge of institutionalized corruption in the sheriff's office? Is this just like one or two bad police officers, or does it, you know, does it extend to the top, or is it, do we have the same problem like we have in San Francisco with Cover Up City?
Well, I think yeah, the abuses would not be happening if they weren't tolerated by the. Management.
Wait a minute, you're not talking about Sheriff Mark Tracy, are you?
Yeah.
What about DA Bob Lee? Surely he's going to run in with guns blazing and stop this corruption.
Yeah, right. Now, his response to all of this is, well, people lie.
Well, what about Judge Art Danner? He's certainly had his, you know, he's seen the DA's office head on for many years. Now he's in a position to take judicial action.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll tell you this. As you know, the previous sheriff, Al Noren, had lots of problems, but one thing he didn't countenance was lying on the part of his officers, and he was really strong about that. But Mark Tracy not only countenances it, he, you know, he seems to encourage it. I don't know. I'm that's my opinion.
Is this because Tracy is a sort of a weak sister, if you forgive the sexist reference, a weak manager, or because he, you know, somehow just has a different standard? I mean, in other words, is there a group of officers in the department that sort of does this habitually who are old timers, like there was with the Code Blue in the police department, the folks who were beating up homeless people in the late 70s?
I'll tell you one thing, I think, and that actually comes out of my opinion on this actually comes out of the Hartzner case.
Mm-hmm.
The sheriffs, and I assume the police department as well, they have these amazing civil service contracts that where they have every protection in the world. This is every job protection that you can imagine. A lot of this stems from the fact that they often give these protections in lieu of an increase in salary, and they're you know, additional benefits that they get, and you know, one of them being that they, you know, that the county council represents them for free, and when they're sued, even if it's individual lawsuit, and like I said, the Hartzner case. It kind of shows us how secure their jobs are.
That doesn't mean, however, that homeless people can't take them to small claims court.
Oh,
where
not at all.
Attorneys,
I mean,
can't go there.
Let me say what the Hartzner case was, just to tell the listeners in mm-hmm. case they aren't aware of the facts. Sergeant Hartzner, I don't know, 20-year veteran of the sheriff's department, stole fireworks from the property room in the sheriff's department, that confiscated fireworks from people, and held a big beer bash at the county building where they set off these firecrackers, fireworks, and had kegs of beer. I mean, you know, he stole, literally stole property from the evidence from the property department, and he was, you know, credit to Tracy, he fired him. And then the Civil Service Commission, 6 months later, reinstated him with pay.
Because?
They just reinstated him with pay. You got me. I don't know. It's bizarre. But so he got a 6 month paid vacation out of the deal.
Well, it was a traumatic incident being fired. He needed a little chance to rest.
Mm-hmm. So I think that. Part of the problem is that even when they try to get rid of the bad seeds, you know, they have so many job protections. It's kind of like tenure for a teacher. You know, once they achieve that, they, you know, pretty much have to, you know, do something absolutely horrendous to get rid of them.
Hmm.
And so that's part of the problem.
I got you.
Yeah.
Kate, anything else you want to say on other subjects? I know that's what originally why I was going to call you, and I appreciate your patience at getting this impromptu call.
Okay.
Anything? I know I was on the peace march yesterday that went from the town clock down to Raymond, and then to the I didn't go to Lighthouse Field, but that's where it ended up. And I was I was always glad to see people marching for peace, although we had these monitors who were so busily trying to keep people on the sidewalks that. Do the police officer's job, make it all sort of more orderly, more off to the side. I felt people should have taken the streets, and indeed people did at some points.
Mm.
And I guess what I noticed as I gave out flyers was that there seemed to be a growing attitude of coldness and hostility towards either, maybe it was me in my George GW International Terrorist T-shirt, you know, it could have been. But I was
getting Madman loose, and it's not Saddam Hussein. Right?
There are several of them. One of them's got more weapons than the other. That's for damn sure. But I notice this growing coldness, and then I read in today's Sentinel, and I also saw it in the Washington Post. There's a study, the latest poll. Of course, these polls are always pretty much bullshit in some respects because you don't know what questions they're asking, or at least I can't see from this story.
Yeah.
But the claim is that. The Americans, 7 in 10, now back the Iraq war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't, does that mean we support our troops? Because you can support your troops.
I do think there's some confusion there. And the people that I have talked to who have kind of changed their position since the war started, they equate the protests with being anti-troops. In other words, against our fighting boys over there. Which, it couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, obviously, those who want the war to continue are, putting the boys at much more risk than if we, immediately call a halt to the shock and thaw, as they...
Schlock and maw, yeah.
Yeah. But, I think that's part of the problem. I think that that's just... I don't know. And plus, I think you're right. It's who's running the polls, and it's just like the media. Obviously, the media is not neutral. I mean, it's an arm of political of the political fodder that
embedded journalists and all that stuff.
Well, you look at I don't know if you've watched, but NBC's coverage of the war is called. Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Yeah.
That's not a neutral position, excuse me.
Well, it is the name that the Pentagon has given to this particular U.S. operation.
Well, I know, but they should have better sense than to, but of course, we've talked about this before, NBC is owned by GE, which is a major defense contractor. They're making huge amounts of money off of this war.
But I do notice at least we aren't getting this moo stuff anymore. You don't see the acronym COW, Coalition of the Willing, anymore. It's U.S. troops and British troops.
Right.
And that's it. So a little truth in journalism is sort of seeping in there.
Yeah. But your mention about what's happening in Santa Cruz, and I said this to you when we talked earlier, but, you can imagine if that's happening in Santa Cruz, what it's like, in the whole big midsection of the United States,
Well, I talked to someone in DeSoto, Michigan, former activist Jane Immler, who... was responsible for setting up cold and rainy night shelters here and food programs and went to jail repeatedly and did civil disobedience here. She says there is still a very strong anti-war current in the DeSoto. And if you look at the pro-war protests, they aren't that big. And the big ones were orchestrated by Clear Channel, the right-wing, the biggest white right-wing conglomerate media group. So... I talked to an activist the other day, Phil Baer, who I share many things in common with and also disagree with him on a number of issues. He's been supporting Bush, but he told me candidly, and I guess maybe this is sort of real politique, if the troops get bogged down there, that's all going to evaporate, The people who are supporting him now will be calling for his head very shortly.
Well, clearly I think that when you look at this as a chess game, which is kind of cold, I guess. But I think that we are going to probably win this battle. But the ultimate decider is whether or not we're going to win the war on terrorism, and obviously, you know, in my opinion, it's going to be much worse. And I think I forget what columnist, maybe it was Thomas Friedman from the New York Times, talked about the 6-day war in Israel, and said something about the fact that they have been forever stuck in the seventh day, which is, I think, pretty astute. I think that's what's happened. I mean, they may have won this battle, but, you know, they're stuck in a war for the rest of their lives, you know? I mean, it's and that's what I see happening here.
Well, another thing that annoys me, if you look at the front page of the Chronicle and the Mercury News today, Chronicle's front page is War Turns to Terror.
Yeah.
Deadly suicide attack heralds mm-hmm. ominous new Iraqi tactic.
Right.
Well, this ominous new Iraqi tactic killed 4 American soldiers.
I know.
You know, in the same amount of time, how many Iraqi...
You know, I mean, that's just so crazy. That's like the opening scene of Butch Cassidy where he says, now let's get the rules straight before they fight.
Well, I don't know. I mean, a terrorist tactic is one where it seems to me that's been traditionally used to apply to civilians, like the 9/11.
Right.
You know, like civilian airplane hijackings and
bombs
and markets.
Well, you know, here we have this country with every bit of military might and technology available to humankind against, you know, an army that obviously has been declared to not have any real weapons by Hans Blix. Of course, we found that out before we attacked them, right? We made sure they were defenseless.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what in the hell are they supposed to do? You know, I mean, they're trying everything in the book. I mean, that's just, you know, it's... Anyway, it's a pretty pathetic situation, and I love the fact that, you know, they're absolutely sure that all of the Iraqi citizens that have been killed by Iraqi weapons, right, instead of ours.
Well, it seems only fair because since most of the American casualties are by American and British weapons.
Exactly. yeah, exactly.
Listen, we've been talking with Attorney Kate Wells. Kate, I appreciate your you know, being with us.
Okay.
Feel free to call back.
All right, thanks.
Try to get a radio where you can hear us, for God's sake.
Okay.
Hey.
I'll talk to you later.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Give us a call. Lines are open, 427-3772. Got a caller earlier who said that he was interested in what's happening at the town clock and the stuff around the Iraqi war, but wondered why we spent so much time going into this business about corruption in the sheriff's office. And I guess I'd like to see people come forward with sworn accounts and with documentation, which is what I think I see Fernando and Ana Espino coming forward with. Again, I'm not a master of all their information. I'm presenting their accounts. I went by the sheriff's office a week and a half ago and left a message for Sergeant Deverell telling him that this was going to be broadcast, and he had an opportunity if he wanted to respond. And any member of the Sheriff's Department or friend of Sergeant Deverell's or independent party who wants to talk about this case can certainly call in and talk about it. And I can even arrange for you to have even equivalent airtime if you'd like to talk about that. And the phone number to call for there off-air is 423-4833, and on-air is 427-3772. Couple things have happened on the homeless front that I think are very positive, and I actually have written about them for the next issue of Street Spirit, the homeless newspaper sold by homeless people for change. They can get the hell off the streets at night, at least to sit in a coffee shop and try to take an hour or two away from the threat of being arrested by police for sleeping, which, by the way, apparently is now on big time. The deal struck at the town clock between the vigilers and homeless supporters, or just homeless folks who are looking for a place to huddle together and some security and some some comfort, relative comfort, human comfort. They were told, you have to clean it all up, and they were told stuff about dogs, and they were told you can't have flowers in these areas, and then they brought in police to protect the cleaners of the clock. They brought in 8 police officers to guard the parks and rec officials for fear that these peace protesters might attack them with, placards or, roses. I don't know what they would have. I guess roses are kind of expensive. Then they told them, well, you have to vacate the town clock every night from 1 a.m. to 8 a.m. At least that's what the sign says, because it's a, quote, park, you see. And thanks to former superintendent of parks, Jim Lang, and his compliant city council, and Dick Wilson, the city manager, you have a situation where it is illegal to be in a park after dark in Santa Cruz. So public space is being denied to the entire community, but of course this particularly impacts homeless people, and it also impacts protesters because the town clock, which was never a quote, park until city council members wanted to get rid of homeless protesters there during the first Iraqi war and had it declared a park, they can now use this law to harass and ticket people. And they do. They, at least they threaten to harass and ticket them. And if they can threaten people and get them to behave without actually writing a ticket, all the better. That's the issue. Here we got an incoming call. Let's see what we got here. Hi, you're on free radio.
Yes, can I get on the talk show?
Sure. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, well, you were asking for the facts. I'm not sure whether you referred to facts about the war in Iraq or some situations in the cruise, but referring to terrorist tactics, do you have any comment on suicide bomber in Israel injuring 35 civilians in solidarity with Iraq? How do you call that? Is that terrorist or not terrorist?
That's exactly what I was saying, that attacks on civilians seem to me to be terrorism, whereas this Iraqi attack by military people, disguised military people, it's not the fact, the details aren't clear, but if it's disguised military people or civilians against the military, that doesn't, to me, seem to be terrorism of the same sort as against civilians. It seems to me that they're spinning it as terrorism in order to distract from other things. I'm talking about the U.S. military.
Yeah, I agree with you, actually. That should not be called terrorism, but there is nothing wrong with that being called terrorist tactics. It means they apply the same methods against military, and you cannot call them terrorists because of that, but those are terrorist tactics.
Okay, well,
all right.
I hear you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, they're definitely certainly unconventional tactics, and they certainly are being done in a context which casts some, put the rest of the Iraqi population at a greater risk, though they're already pretty much at risk. But if other people have vehicles that genuinely break down, they want the military to help them. The military is going to remember that the last time this happened, or at least somewhere in the past, they went over there and they got the blown up. So that certainly is true. Of course, my perspective is it's also, if the military is invading a country, then having civilians resist, whether by suicide bombing, homicide bombing, sniping, whatever, in or out of uniform, acquires a different kind of legitimacy and will certainly be called terrorism by the occupying forces. The British called it terrorism in different countries and so forth when it happened in Malaysia and elsewhere. And the Americans will probably call it terrorism when it happened in the Philippines in the 1890s. But if you're on the other side, it's freedom fighting. Looks like we may have an incoming call here. I thought I saw one. Yeah, we do. Hi there, you're on free radio.
Hi. It seems like terrorists really ought to be reserved for randomness as well. Where nothing is the terrorist attack on the armed forces invading a country, or terrorist tactics. But it is terrorist tactics, it seems to me, to drop a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is terrorist tactics to firebomb Dresden. And it is terrorist tactics to do what the United States has been doing all over the world, and most recently in Baghdad. Mm-hmm. That certainly is terrorist tactics, because it's totally random. It's against the civilian population. It's not only terrorist, it's a war crime.
Would you agree?
Whereas terrorist tactics are being reserved for the actions of the poor against the mightily armed.
Would you agree, caller, that with the other caller, that Palestinian bombings of civilians in Israel, civilian bombings are terrorist tactics?
Yes, but I would also make a distinction as to when they're the only tactics that are open to are available to a certain people. When you have a totally captive population in Israel, and it's being made war on with tanks against children in the street throwing stones, then obviously what the suicide bombers are making a statement, and the statement that they're making seems to me very plain, which is that life isn't worth living under the circumstances in which Israel is imposing it on the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Any further points you wish to make?
No, I guess for the time being.
And a good point it was, caller.
What?
And succinctly made, I might add.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know that's important when I call in.
Well, you know me. I'm pretty quick with the cutoff switch here.
What?
I'm quick on the cutoff switch.
Yeah, with me, with certain people you're not. For instance, I would be sort of interested in finding out, Robert, what is the long conversation that you had with Fernando and so on certainly points to a difficulty, but normally it's the kind of conversation that one has with one's attorney or with someone who at least holds out the promise of being able to do something about it, because otherwise you get people talking endlessly, and there certainly are, all of us could talk endlessly, I think, about our problems with the corporate state.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I saw it as, first of all, he went public with it at the Board of Supervisors. He had a lot of documentation. He's in the middle of a trial on the issue, and it concerns individuals who have been named and who seem to be notorious for misconduct, Sergeant Deverell, for instance, in other contexts. And I guess also I think it points to a system of institutionalized abuse in the sheriff's office. So, I mean, in a way, you're right. I mean, probably that whole thing could have been cut back to 5 or 10 minutes, possibly, without a lot of...
Well, even so, my mania is to be talking about something that we can do something about,
right,
or which at least clears the decks for some kind of action that we can take.
Mm-hmm.
And just to, I think it's demoralizing ultimately to go on and on and on about something with no solution offered or no promise of a solution.
Well, he has gotten the charges against him dropped, except for one minor charge. And it looks like he's successfully fought his way that far. But I really, I'm going to wait until I get him in the studio and I get a... hopefully she'll have an attorney next week. She goes back to court, I believe, on April 3rd in Barton's Court. For those who are interested in checking that out, that, I guess, would be Wednesday. No, it's Thursday, the 3rd. And I'll be able to give a report on that as well. But, yeah, I agree with you. It's best to talk about stuff you can do something about. And I guess
one thing I feel it's very important about this war, I may have said it before, and that is to realize that horrible as what the catastrophe in Iraq is, this is the opening salvo, I believe, of the final battle of the not to get too pompous about it, but really the final battle between the corporation and the earth. Call it the bank and the earth, and that's what's really been shown, is that people know this in an intuitive way, even when they're not fully conscious of it. By the marches that are being shown are not just against the United States and what the United States is doing, but in so many countries of the world, they're the people basically squaring off against their corporate government. And, in Australia, in all sorts of places, I mean, everywhere, all the Arab states and so on, all the governments that have been cowed into supporting...
Cowed? Is that some kind of pun?
What?
Go ahead. Cowed. Coalition of the Willing.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
The Coalition of the Willing. You're right. The Coalition of the Bullied and the Bribed.
Mm-hmm. Cobb.
The CBB.
I catch your point. Let me roll to another caller now, though, because I'm realizing I only have about 45 minutes left.
Okay, well, it's just good to keep a double focus. That's all I'm trying to say, is to realize that the enemy is the corporate state that's destroying the world, and it it's also the World Trade Organization. It wasn't an accident that it was the World Trade Towers that were being bombed. It wasn't Americans that were being attacked. It was the World Trade behemoth.
Thank you. And phone lines are open, 427-3772. Washington Post headlines today do provide, in a way, kind of a backhanded hope. Bush reaffirms war plan, backs push to Baghdad. That's the same old stuff. Bush defends conduct of the war, defends. U.S. has found no banned weapons. Political military aims diverge. Top military leaders say they need to effectively restart the war. I guess they think they're playing some kind of war game they want to try again. Arab TV shows different war. Few Shiites expect liberation. Arab world outrage spreads. Saudis seething with anger against U.S. Images of death, ruin, cause setback. This is in the Washington Post, mind you. We're not talking about Counterpunch or some foreign networks or places where you would expect more balanced coverage. This is in the establishment papers, so it's interesting. Subheadlines, Pentagon says some missiles strayed. U.S. halts Tomahawks over Saudi Arabia. So even as I'm feeling kind of the depression of the factionalism locally, and there's been a lot of factionalism and seems to be a falling off of peace activism in some ways, though maybe people are just sort of kind of recharging their batteries and figuring out what to do next. And even as we see this media-contrived jingoist herd-behind-the-leader mentality, which has, as I noticed yesterday on this march, and giving out flyers to people on the streets on Pacific Avenue, a kind of a coldness toward activists, even anger on occasion. There's also indication of the early war weariness and division in the establishment press. And I think this means we just got to be patient, we got to be persistent. The update from the town clock, I invite folks to call in. As I understand it, talking to Gabe yesterday, who is one of the, he's been down in Vandenberg doing actions down there, and I hope to find his interview probably in time for next Thursday. But he stated that there is no real continuing vigil at the moment at the town clock. It's kind of, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. And as I was saying before, the caller called in, the police have been using this tactic of increasingly small bites of the salami till, you know, there's no salami left in terms of your civil rights at the clock. They've said, well, you have to move off the clock from 1 to 8 and be on the sidewalk. Then they said if anybody sleeps there, they'll be ticketed or arrested under the sleeping ban or the camping ordinance. But you can sleep across the street at the post office, but that apparently was removed yesterday because some postal employee complained. So even when it's not during postal hours, if they find you sleeping there, according to what I heard from Gabe, and he may have gotten it secondhand too, or maybe not, I'm not sure, police are essentially using these little tactics to say, oh, you can talk to us, you can negotiate with us, just give up your rights here, give up your rights there, give it all up piece by piece, and then eventually, you know, and we'll do a deal with you. And sometimes, of course, I'm not saying one shouldn't negotiate with the police, so the people who are out there doing this vigil are, you know, put a lot of time and energy into it. They got some support, but not the support I think that they really needed. And you do your deals, you know, when you can, with whom you need to do. But the other way to do it, of course, is to stand up and take the tickets and have a lot of people come down and take them with you. We have an incoming call. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hello.
Hi.
Howard?
Yes. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. I think it's interesting the micro and the macro here that's coming down on your show today.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that as long as we're in bodies, and the reason why Shakespeare is still current,
mm-hmm.
Is that there are certain motivations that occur,
mm-hmm.
and will continue to occur. And we need to work towards peace and exposing the scoundrels and all that, but it's a perpetual dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we do ourselves wrong to look for UFOs and new paradigms to release us from this condition.
The poor are always with us sort of thing? Or?
I guess so. That's one way to put it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think as long as we're in our bodies, and certainly just to use that, that line of yours, the poor are always with us, it's the poor numerically induce a class culture. they endorse Las Vegas and Taj Mahal and Versailles, and you can only blame the media directive for greater market share partially. These are people that are paid to produce certain positions, right, for the media. But it's the people ultimately to decide that they like glitter and lifestyles of the rich and famous, and they like Prince Charles and Lady Di, and wasn't the Taj Mahal beautiful, and Versailles is certainly, were better off they have had it built than to not have had it
built.
Well,
I don't think most of the people in the world feel that way.
I think it's the vast, overwhelming majority of the people in the world.
I don't know. Islamic fundamentalists may take issue with you on that one.
I don't think so. You don't see Islamic fundamentalists standing up against the Saudi royal family, who are so fabulously wealthy they can't spend it.
But you see them in mass
except to fund quote terrorism,
uh-huh.
And even then they don't expend their resources.
Uh-huh.
These are despots.
What about our local despots in the sheriff's department? Any comments on these?
Well, as above, so below. Micro, macro, exposed to scoundrels. There are unquestionably scoundrels in the local environment. I find it interesting that you don't see the marquee names of Santa Cruz protest regarding local abuse of power issues.
Well,
and I would argue that there is some degree of relevance in this. Because the human condition exists here in Santa Cruz, but it's so much easier and less threatening to cast one's aspersions 3,000 miles away.
Do we have the human condition, or do we have the Sergeant Deverell condition? That's my question.
Well,
you yourself have had some experience with this, Sergeant.
Yes, there's no question, and I know what the brick wall is, and.
Can you briefly?
You know, who's an interesting person in this regard, Robert, is
mm-hmm.
Ben Robertson, whom I would suggest
would make
an interesting guest.
Mm-hmm.
All right, he has a perspective that has truth within it.
Gravity is the fourth dimension.
What happens is that the
mm-hmm.
same names come up time and time and time again, and what you find out is that, as Ben has told me many, many years ago, it doesn't matter what the truth is, because you will be marginalized, you'll be outspent, you'll find out that these guys are immune.
Well, you had this incident with Deverell. Can you just summarize it briefly, please?
I will in this context, and then I'm going to let it go. In
okay.
fact, I know Dave Ginocchio. Dave Ginocchio was part of of an attempt to rile me in front
Ginocchio
of the
post office. Ginocchio was one of the DA's office?
Along with then Chief Deputy DA John Hopkins and local attorney Dana Scruggs.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Dana Scruggs came back and tried to kind of push my buttons again, and he had a little boy with him.
Focus on Deverell.
And I asked him what his name was, and the little boy says, Dana Scruggs, and what's your phone number? The little boy gives me their own unlisted home phone number. It's an interesting little story of the level to which scoundrels and people that think that they're in positions where they can't
caller,
touch
tell us
will,
about
go,
Deverell.
Will go to deny and discredit the truth.
Tell us about Deverell. And his relationship in this situation.
The truth is, who discredits whom?
Mm-hmm.
And let me let it go at that. I want to bring out that
so you have nothing
micro
to say.
And a macro. And what happened
yeah.
to us, because there were many of us in the mid-90s that challenged the status quo here in Santa Cruz, is that you find out what it's like to be marginalized. And
well,
on the
are you going to take a chance and give us some specifics?
Because people are afraid of the truth. Now, this story, whether it has merit or not, that you were the first part of your show was about.
Until
that kind of stuff hits the front page of the Sentinel and stays
right. Well,
it's not going to go
it
anywhere.
It might if people like yourself came forward and could answer some questions. You want to tell us a little about Deverell and your experience with him? Or
I'll go one line further with it, and then I would like to drop it. One more sentence. Three-part sentence. Deverell drooled. Flores had a quota. Danner chose cover-up.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, nobody knows what you're talking about except you and those who were around in the early 90s. Can you tell us what you know?
What I could say is that mm-hmm. it doesn't matter what the truth is.
I understand that that is your position. Obviously, that's not my position, or I wouldn't be doing this radio show, would I?
Because if you expose an incident of
and I don't think
play,
it's your position either. I think
what happens is that they're liable.
Anyway,
okay. You see, that's not going to happen. That's why the county council exists, Robert.
What was your experience with Sergeant Deverell that might be helpful for us to know?
My experience with Sergeant Deverell is that he's simply not an honorable man.
In that
the truth does not matter.
And what did he lie about?
What matters is that I can do what I can do, and there's nothing you're going to do about it.
What in fact, persuaded you that he was not an honorable man?
That he would not listen to me. It didn't matter what I had to say. It didn't matter.
So he ignored,
it didn't matter what the truth was.
He ignored your concerns. Did he falsify
completely.
Did he falsify a police report?
That I won't comment on, nor do I know whether he did. What I allege is that a false police report was filed against me.
And was he the author of the report?
Yes.
I see.
And Ray Flores was the detective that grilled me.
Well, I don't want to try to...
There's certain things you never forget.
Yeah.
My first conversation with Flores is an incident regarding your ex-girlfriend. We know you were at the house May 31st. This was 10 years ago.
So this is a domestic...
Charges are ultimately dropped.
An alleged domestic
right.
violence.
And I kept telling him, this is about a repossessed car. Listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, these guys are... You know, what are you going to do? So charges are dropped after I'm mugshotted and fingerprinted. And went through months of continuances.
Mm-hmm.
And so what? So
sounds
go away
familiar.
Now.
Yeah.
And the whole chain of command, the whole DA's office, and what I saw afterwards when I got involved with the Danner recall, it does not matter what the truth is. It's about who discredits whom. And you will be put on the fringe by those that consider themselves to be progressive and activists because they're afraid of local application of values.
I think you're right in that respect. I think that certainly that attempt will be made. It always is made, you know, and often it succeeds.
Well, Robert, you have a place in this town because you allow these kinds of discussions to occur. And I don't agree with you on a lot of your positions, but on this particular issue, which has merit, and is the most suppressed issue that there is, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I really am bored with the not that they don't have their place, but the protesters about the 3,000-mile-away conflict. You know, what bores me is that they don't have a context for that same kind of activism when it boils down to where the rubber meets the road in their own community.
Well,
I don't see it. I've never seen it.
That's why I call it the our protest, the war.
Now, Richard Quigley has certain things to say
against
about
two
Sergeant
wars,
Deverell, too, right? These are guys that expose their tactics. It's not that they're wrong all the time, but that they're wrong sometimes, but they're never accountable.
Correct.
If you're never accountable, you're beyond reproach. There is no such thing as law, then, and equal justice for the law.
Similarly, Bush isn't accountable. We have the same problem, you know, nationally.
Well, we do. I'll say this about that. When they use this tactics of this phraseology, this PR, that the Iraqis are not playing fair.
Mm-hmm.
According to international law of war, I mean, that gets pretty newspeak right there. Do you follow what I'm saying? When they use that tactic, I think there are arguments that the world has changed dramatically since post-1989, and that the place of the United States is radically different than it was 15 years ago. Now, whether that justifies the attack on Iraq or not, I'll leave... ambiguous. But when the United States government uses this, and these are the party hacks that come out, and they'll be on CNN and all that, and they'll use a similar line that the Iraqis are against international law of war.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that is so doublespeak, insincere.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, it's for mobilize the American people behind the government. That's the deal.
There must be other ways to do these kinds of activities than to use deceptive language.
Oh, yeah. You put big, you know, video game military displays and have people kind of get involved with those for a while. Then you get them outraged and you send pictures of the dead home and support our troops. It's all, you know, it's traditional. It's been done in war after war.
Now, my opinion about the Iraqi war is that it should have happened in December. In my opinion, this dragged on so long.
You're a premature hawk there, Robert.
If it was going to happen, and it seemed to me that the administration, that these are the heads of state, and Bush is the commander-in-chief by 5-4 Supreme Court vote. I mean, that's the way the law falls, and we can challenge the process along the way, and I think we will indefinitely. But the fact of the matter is that George W. is the president of the United States and the commander-in-chief. And the trend was towards this for a while.
He is
certainly
the Fuhrer. He is
9/11.
The Fuhrer, yes.
Okay. But, you know, let's be above board about who we are and why we are. And, of course, the Iraqis are going to use tactics like the Japanese did.
Well, particularly when your homeland is invaded. But I got a roll on you, Bob. Any final words?
If we have the righteous cause in the Middle East, it'll bear out over the course of time.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 427-3772 is the phone line. Lines are open. I want to point out I got a call from Mayor Emily Riley, not to the show. She's never called the show, but she did leave me a message saying that at the town hall meeting on Iraq on April 7th, I believe it is, there will be 5 minutes for HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Of course, she said this last time, and then she only gave us 3 minutes. We're not sure. I'm not sure exactly. She's a mayor who's prone to change her mind. Some would say she's prone to break her word. We'll see if she keeps her word this time. I got her on tape, but hey, we've got Bush on tape, too, and that doesn't mean too much, does it? Also, Michael Rotkin, council member and former mayor, the longest sitting, standing, or lying in more ways than one, council member on the Santa Cruz City Council. He's been there on and off since 1979. We'll be coming on free radio to debate, and the actual issue on the debate is a little bit vague at the moment, but it has to do with Rotkin's criticisms of the Peace Coalition activists who did not let Farr speak at a large rally of an anti-war rally back in February this year because Farr had not, the activists felt that Farr was, you know, there were other speakers before him, he had not gotten the okay from them, and also he was essentially, he had voted for the biggest military appropriation in history, he voted for uranium-depleted weapons, his anti-war position was partial, perhaps half-hearted, and perhaps opportunistic, and Rotkin had some strong words of criticism for what he called them idiots, activist idiots, I'm not quite sure, I've got to look at that letter again, but he will be coming on free radio with Joe Williams, 10 o'clock on April 13th. To debate back and forth on the issue of, Farr's place in the peace community. In a way, I'd like to see it expanded to talk about holding politicians, both local and national, accountable. But it's going to be something in that general area, and it has to do with those issues. And it'll be starting at 10 o'clock on Sunday, 2 weeks from today. And I invite you all to tune in to that. You can call in now. Free Radio Santa Cruz is taking calls at 96.3 at 427-3772. Good news from Santa Barbara. Here's a story you will be hearing or reading in the Street Spirit when it comes out in about a week. Santa Barbara homeless activists stop enforcement of city's laws against RVs. 3 years ago, the Committee for Social Justice in Santa Barbara began its push to educate politicians about the naked fact that affordable housing for a poor person in Santa Barbara is likely as not a vehicle. Poet and activist Peter Marin struggled unsuccessfully through meeting after meeting to get the city and county of Santa Barbara to set aside parking places for those living in their vehicles. They established space for only 15 vehicles in a town where Homes on Wheels there estimates 400 vehicles are occupied by more than 500 people. During that time, former public defender chief Glenn Maurer successfully fielded scores of homeless cases, reversing several camping convictions with the important necessity defense that violating laws regarding habitating vehicles is justified to avoid greater evils. In response to these successes with the necessity defense, city authorities ignored their own task force recommendations and passed two new ordinances criminalizing van dwellers. One set an ironclad two-hour limit on parking an RV anywhere in Santa Barbara. The second banned all RV parking from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. on all public streets and parking lots. Over 100 tickets have been issued under these laws, according to Maurer, with $23 fines for each ticket, multiple unpaid fines leading to vehicle booting and subsequent towaways or home nappings. Fighting these harassment tickets requires a tedious and time-consuming journey through an administrative process, also true in Santa Cruz, by the way, first in the police department, then in front of an SBPD-appointed hearing officer, then an appeal to a regular court, then a trial before a judge. After all this, it's still not clear that the necessity defense can be as strongly argued because the process is civil and administrative rather than criminal. On March 19th, Glenn Maurer struck back, filing for an injunction against the two roll-along-the-homeless laws. Scouring law books and legal precedents, Maurer came up with several arguments. The state vehicle code preempts the field with its requirement that you can't enforce any parking limits unless they are universally posted so as to provide adequate notice to vehicle owners. City authorities don't want to post, you can only park here for 2 hours on every street in the city, or you can't park at all between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. on every street in the city. And on March 25th, at a hearing, acknowledged as much. The city attorney indicated he would be trying to post appropriate notices on all incoming roads. As for 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., no homeless parking signs, and we've seen Emily Riley do that here with 5 a.m. to 7 a.m., no parking stuff out in the Harvey West, and we've seen the permit parking process citywide, where that suddenly it'll be illegal to park your vehicle on any street anywhere unless you have a permit or in any parking lot where it is now currently legal. Glenn Maurer argued that the city cannot ban RVs as a special class of vehicles, and that is not a part of Santa Cruz law, but apparently it is a part of Santa Barbara law that is being contested. An attorney general's opinion held you ban all types of vehicles or you ban none. Additionally, the tangle wire of laws in Santa Barbara attacking homeless people violates the right to travel. When taken together, these laws, those against sleeping in vehicles, those that bar living in recreational vehicles outside parks, the 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. parking ban, the law against parking for longer than 2 hours anywhere in the city, together these laws present an impassable barrier for any RV user trying to travel, whether you're homeless or not, or whether you live in your RV or not. On Tuesday, March 25th, a local judge required Maurer to refile in 2 days, seeking a shorter-term temporary restraining order. If Judge James Brown doesn't grant this TRO, Maurer still has the trial to convince Brown to throw out the oppressive laws. Excoriating politicians who have defeated efforts to set up legal RV parking areas, Peter Marin said, "I'm too old to have any hopes about changing the minds of bureaucrats, but it is astonishing. People should make note that this is a liberal council in Santa Barbara that voted 4-3 against the Iraqi war. It, however, voted 5-2 in favor of depriving the homeless of a place to park their vehicles and against any alternative public space for them to park. What we have here are clearly liberal people fucking over the poor. Not surprising. It is fundamentally a war between classes, not a difference of opinion between Democrats and Republicans. On many of these issues, ostensibly liberal people can be just as bad, or worse, than conservatives. It's important that people not misunderstand who's doing this to whom." And yet, the story has a happy ending, or so far. On Thursday, March 27th, Judge Brown granted a temporary restraining order against these two laws targeting RVs. He prohibited their enforcement pending more argument on April 11th. So homeless people for the next 2 weeks can park on the streets in their RVs, even between the hours of 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. And the two-hour limit simply for RVs is not a law that can be enforced. Good work, Glenn Maurer. Good work, Santa Barbara homeless activists. And you'll be able to read this story, as well as a longer one by Becky Johnson about the Santa Cruz situation, the town clock, peace vigil, and so forth, in the upcoming issue of Street Spirit, which, as I said, will be on the streets probably in about a week, week and a half. And here's some bad news. Democrats vow to quickly okay more military funding. And this is from the Washington Post of yesterday. Actually, it's a CNN story. The U.S. Congress will act immediately and with a unity of purpose to approve President Bush's request for emergency funding for the military to complete its mission in Iraq, Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, said Saturday. When America sends its sons and daughters to war, we have an obligation to provide all the resources they need, he said in the weekly Democratic radio address. In a promise that Congress will provide the emergency funding soon, Dorgan said, "Our soldiers are prepared to make the ultimate sacrifice for their country." Actually, it's for their Führer, it looks like to me. "And we must do our part. And that means voting for the funds they need to finish the job." But, and then Dorgan takes issue with the president on the issue of the budget for the next fiscal year. So it's okay to break the budget by endorsing this incredible military adventure, but he will criticize the budget after that. Now, I don't know how Dorgan represents other folks here, but I want to point out that some of us are not happy about that. I, for one, and tomorrow I will be at Representative Farr's office. He's our congressional representative. And I will encourage you, all of you out there, to join me. 2 o'clock tomorrow, Representative Farr's office. And here's the reason, and I'm reading to you from a flyer. How about it, Sam Farr? Will you vote to bring our troops home? Ask your representative in Congress. Monday, March 31st, 2 p.m., 701 Ocean Street. In October, Farr voted for the biggest military appropriation in U.S. history. On the same day he voted against the use of force in Iraq, Farr has refused to address issues raised by local peace activists. On Thursday, March 20th, Farr abstained on the Hunter resolution, which expressed, quote, the support and appreciation of the nation for the president and the members of the armed forces who are participating in Operation Iraqi Freedom. He did not join Representatives Conyers, McDermott, Honda, Rangel, Waters, Jones, Scott, Watson, Lee, and Stark, who all voted against this. Farr's official website, which is www.house.gov/Farr, as of 3:29, has many paragraphs of links for troops, reservists, and their families, but no links at all to peace groups trying to save our soldiers by bringing them home. His posted 3:20 speech talks about rebuilding Iraq, presumably after years of conquest and occupation, and to support our troops with no mention of bringing them home. This is doublespeak to talk about supporting our troops without getting them out of there. This is doublespeak. It's maybe nationally approved by 70% of the American people, doublespeak. Maybe not, depending on what the questions the Washington Post asked, but it is doublespeak nonetheless. Farr's March 27th Members Against War speech mentions 99% of 8,300 letters he received opposed the war. And while he criticizes Bush's entry into the war, Farr does not call for the withdrawal of troops, for a ceasefire, for a bombing halt, or for any specific measures to reverse the devastation that the U.S. military is creating over there and the endless, bottomless pit and catastrophe that is being created for all of us as well. In spite of repeated phone calls, Farr has not come out against Bush's $75 billion war appropriation, $62 billion of it for the Pentagon, for next month's war activities. That's 1 month of war activities. His staff had no word on how Farr would vote next week. That is to say, Farr is not saying he will vote against this military appropriation, this war appropriation, this terror appropriation, if you will. Local peace activists citing Farr's pro-war votes on Colombia, Yugoslavia, and U.S. use of uranium-depleted weapons rejected him as a speaker at the biggest peace rally in decades in February. And I mentioned that Rotkin is going to be debating Joe Williams on this issue on this radio station on April 13th. Farr ignored community outrage at the February town hall meeting in Santa Cruz and dismissed calls for an impeachment resolution against Bush and other militant measures to stop Bush's bloody war. Call Farr if you wish to confirm or deny any of this. He hasn't called me back, and nor has his staff, since Thursday morning, so there's been no change, and he's not announced he's going to come out against the $62 billion for the military appropriation coming up. You can call him at 429-1976, 429-1976. That's a local call. The flyer suggests you bring cameras, tape recorders, friends, cell phones, signs, bells, whistles, and heart. Support the Town Clock Peace Vigil and other local actions. Support our troops. Pull them out. Show up and stand up. Now, it's not clear whether folks are going to be doing a civil disobedience action or simply registering their concern, their anger, and their outrage with Farr through his staff, since I doubt he'll be there. But I encourage people to come down tomorrow at 2 o'clock to Farr's office. It is at 701 Ocean Street, that's in the county building, the five-story county building on the third floor. Not hard to find. Come in costume if you want. Come as you are. Come naked if you choose. I don't care. A naked protest might certainly get a little protest. I mean, get a little publicity. It doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that we hold our representatives accountable for what they do and what they don't do, where people are dying and killing with the American funds to support the image of a president and his game plan, which has already gone seriously awry. So tomorrow at 2 o'clock. Come on down. If you want more information about this, you can call HUFF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUFF. And I invite people of all shades of opinion to come on down. You know, I mean, this is primarily, this is an anti-war rally, but I also invited Phil Baer to join us. Phil was arrested with us at Farr's office in 1999 when we opposed the Kosovo bombing. This is more U.S. military terrorism. It had, you know, some claim that the Kosovo bombing had more justification because there was so-called ethnic cleansing going on. Now the U.S. apparently is doing its own ethnic cleansing, although, of course, this is just collateral damage. I beg your pardon. That's not ethnic cleansing. It's casualties of war. You know, after all, war is hell, right? So we have about 15 minutes left. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'll have a slug of orange juice here. And interesting stuff I will not be able to get to today is the shocking arrest of yours truly and what to do when the police come to harass you on a minor matter. Here's a quick call, though. Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. It's Neil.
Hey, Neil.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I just was only catching a bit of your program, and you talked about demonstration at Farr's office.
Correct.
Do you know what the purpose for that is?
Yeah, because I'm organizing it.
Okay.
I kind of was just reading a flyer which talked about Farr and his record on the war, which is he's refusing to come out and say he's going to vote against the $62 billion military appropriation for the next month.
Okay.
That's one. He refused to vote against a resolution supporting Bush and the troops, which Lee and others voted against a week ago. Mm. He has not repudiated his vote for the biggest military appropriation in history.